a crescendo to the festivities this holiday season with ABC Classic. Joyous concerts from orchestras around the country. Handel's Messiah, Bach's Christmas Oratorio, and Sydney Philharmonia Choir's Carols at the House. Christmas soundtracks from the screen and festive songs from the stages of Covent Garden and Broadway. Head to the ABC Classic website for your Christmas listening guide this season.
From Wurundjeri Country, I'm Lexi Junawick, and today on The Breakfast Wrap, authorities investigate the training and connections the Bondi gunmen may have had both in Australia and overseas. You'll hear from Foreign Affairs Minister Penny Wong.
Their visit and why they were there, where they went and so on is part of the active investigation.
Also coming up, what can underwater audio recordings of whale songs tell us about their changing migration habits? We speak with a researcher who's helping find out.
They will have a language that will explain certain circumstances and danger.
From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. Police have confirmed the Bondi gunman travelled to the Philippines just weeks before the father and son fatally shot 15 people at a Jewish community event on Sunday. The Philippines Immigration Department says the men arrived in early November, stayed for a month, and listed Davao on the southern island of Mindanao as their final destination. It's a region that's long been linked to terrorist groups and training camps. For more on this, host Melissa Clark spoke with Foreign Affairs Minister Penny Wong.
With the benefit of hindsight, do you think this attack could have been prevented?
Look, the country is in shock and the country is in pain and the country is grieving, especially Jewish Australians. At the same time that we have felt so much pain, we've also seen the best of Australia, and we know we're stronger and all safer when we stand together, and that's what we must now do, to come together, to ensure we act with resolve, to protect all Australians and to protect in particular our Jewish community, and to confront at all levels, government, community, media, anti-Semitism.
I do want to come to some of those broader issues, but for specifically at looking at some of the information we now know about these two men. We know they travelled to a known terrorism hotspot in the southern Philippines and took part in a training camp. Is that the sort of activity by Australian citizens something that Australian authorities or our intelligence partners should be able to detect?
Well, I know it has been confirmed that the attackers travelled to the Philippines prior to this attack. Obviously, as the New South Wales Police have said, their visit and why they were there, where they went and so on is part of the active investigation. Some of the matters that you're referring to are not matters that I can comment on at this point in the investigation, Mel.
Is there any further update then that you can give us following your conversation with your Philippines counterpart yesterday?
Well, look, one of the things I've been doing has been to engage with my foreign counterparts. And we're grateful for their condolences and solidarity. And one of the counterparts I engaged with was Foreign Secretary Lazaro. We appreciate her condolences. You probably understand I can't go into all details of our discussion, but I can say that we, Australia and the Philippines, are long-standing partners on regional security and on related matters, and that will continue.
I appreciate there are limits to what you can say at this point, but we have heard from the FBI Director Kash Patel saying that the US is providing requested intelligence to Australia. We know that the US has a significant presence in the southern part of the Philippines. Would it be fair to presume that the US is offering assistance or coordination where required?
What I can say to Australians is our law enforcement and intelligence agencies are engaging with all relevant foreign counterparts in order to make sure we have the fullest investigation possible.
Minister, has the government done enough over the last 2 years to combat anti-Semitism in Australia?
Look, we have taken many actions, including criminalising hate speech. But what I would say to you is that we all understand we need to do more. We will dedicate every resource required to making sure Jewish Australians are safe and protected. But as Gillian Segal has said publicly, the anti-Semitism envoy, whom I spoke with on Sunday night, if we are to confront anti-Semitism fully, then the government needs to act, and so does all of the community. And we need to draw inspiration from, firstly, the principle that we are stronger and more united when we are united, and also from the example of Ahmed El Ahmed, you know, a Muslim Australian migrant who ran towards danger to save his fellow Australians. And that is the spirit all of us must bring to this.
Gillian Segal said yesterday that there should be a formal statement from the government about the implementation of her recommendations in her report that your government received in July. Likewise, your colleague Josh Burns told the ABC yesterday that he wants to see a timeline and an agenda around dealing with those matters. Will the government give a formal response and a commitment to all of the recommendations in that report?
I think the Prime Minister made clear yesterday he had met with Ms. Segal about her report and what she has said publicly, and certainly that reflects her discussions with me, is that she recognises that whilst we have acted on and will continue to act on the implementation of the plan, that there is more to do.
So will there be a formal written response to the report?
I'll leave that for the Prime Minister to discuss with Ms. Segal. I'm sure those discussions yesterday went to what the next steps are.
Yesterday, the former Prime Minister, John Howard, made some personal criticisms against you and the Prime Minister. He said the decision to recognise a Palestinian state was premature and needlessly provocative, and he questioned why you didn't visit areas of Israel most directly affected by Hamas's assault. What's your response to the former Prime Minister's criticisms?
I this is a time where we are grieving, and I offer my condolences to the Jewish Australians who have lost loved ones, to those. I offer my support to those who are recovering in hospital, and I'm not going to get into a political debate.
Is there anything you would do differently in hindsight over the last 2 years?
I think people would have seen consistently the government, the Prime Minister, all ministers, including I, being very clear about the unacceptable anti-Semitism in our society. I've made that public statement many times. But as I said to you at the outset of this interview, we all have to do more, and I accept that.
Minister for Foreign Affairs, Penny Wong there. And for deeper analysis on the Mindanao region, Mel spoke with Dr. Levi West. He's an internationally recognised authority on terrorism and radicalisation and is currently a research fellow with the Australian National University.
Tell me a bit about Mindanao and which terrorist groups operate there and run these training camps.
Yeah, so the Southern Philippines, as I think many people will have learnt in the last couple of days, has a long history of jihadist and other forms of sort of separatist terrorist violence, I guess we would call it, insurgency and militancy. The southern island of the Philippines, or the southern islands of the Philippines, are overwhelmingly Islamic versus the rest of the Philippines, which is overwhelmingly Catholic, and has a long, long history of resistance going back to, you know, Spanish colonisation a long, long time ago. In more contemporary terms, since the days of Al-Qaeda and the war in Afghanistan, the one against the Soviets, there has been a smattering of footprints within the southern Philippines in the early days of Jamar Islamiyah. They had sophisticated training infrastructure in the southern Philippines. Most people would be more familiar with the 2017 siege in Marawi, but more broadly, there is a whole range of various factions and sub-factions of jihadist militant organisations that operate across the southern Philippines.
We know that ASIO has investigated the son of the pair, Naveed Akram, for his associations in Sydney, not for any actions he undertook himself. But where someone has previously been looked at by security agencies, would we then expect that if they travelled somewhere with known links to training camps and regular extremist activity. Is that something that you would expect a security agency to pick up?
So I think there's a couple of things here, and it's probably important. The first one is a time piece, right? So he's investigated in 2019, and he's investigated as a peripheral actor. He wasn't a central person of interest, and was deemed to have not presented any threat. As much as I want security services to be able to prevent the kinds of things that happened on Sunday, I'm also not. I don't think people should be entirely comfortable with the idea that if you get investigated once by a security service, found to be of no concern, that they would just keep you on the books and in a file somewhere so that when you went and did something 5 years later, right, there's a reasonable period of time between when he was investigated and when they've gone to the Philippines and then subsequently done the attack. The other part of that, though, is that, and I say this from the advantage of post hoc, right, all of these things make a great deal more sense when you look at them after someone's done a terrorist attack and everyone asks questions about why X, Y, and Z wasn't identified. It was mostly because the person hadn't committed a terrible terrorist attack yet. But there are some questions. I think probably the most substantive one is about you can't just go to the Southern Philippines and show up Islamic State-run training camp and ask. There's a level of connectivity and a set of relationships that you would need to have in place. And the questions, I think, are probably more about how those were able to be established without that raising some kind of concern somewhere within the system. So, you know, there's some substantial questions about how it is that someone, even if they hadn't been investigated in 2019, was able to build those kinds of relationships to such an extent that they were able to travel over there and potentially wind up engaging with a jihadist training camp. And I think that's probably where the big question is.
Dr. Levi West there. Staying with the Bondi terror attack, and in the aftermath of the deadly shooting, the outpouring of grief on home soil and across the globe continues. At the same time, political tensions are rising, especially in the area of Australia's gun laws and whether they need to be bolstered. For his view, Mel spoke with leader of the Nationals, David Littleproud.
We've had the former Nationals leader, your colleague, Michael McCormack. He's been opposed to the idea of gun reform here. Do you agree with his sentiment that, you know, access to guns isn't an issue when it comes to this attack?
Well, the current gun laws were not the problem. It was the people who were using the guns and using the bombs. They were terrorists. This was an act of terror that slaughtered innocent Australians, that targeted Jewish Australians in the most heinous act. The fact is that the gun laws in this country have worked, and the reality is that what the Prime Minister is actually trying to do is deviate from the fact of his failure of attacking and addressing the anti-Semitism that is in this country. And what we should be focused on as a country is this hate towards the Jewish community in this country. That has been a missed opportunity since the 8th of October 2023, when the signs were there, the imam on the steps.
Sorry to interrupt. I do want to come to the broader issue of how anti-Semitism has been tackled. But just to stay focused on the idea of gun reform at the moment, guns might not be a motive, but they are a means by which someone can commit a crime. Your coalition partner, the Liberals, via opposition leader Susan Lee, has said that she is willing to take a look at gun reform proposals. Do you see that cutting the means by which people can commit heinous crimes like this is a reason to strengthen gun laws?
If you are committed to go and slaughter innocent Australians at Bondi Beach, you are going to find means to find a weapon, whether it be a gun, whether it be a knife, whether it be a vehicle, whether it be a bomb. Just understand what currently happens, that what's been proposed around the registry, that's something that has already been supported, already been announced. That's around law enforcement agencies being able to share who owns guns, who has licences. Let me make it also clear that to get a gun license in this country, you have to undergo a fit and proper person test. You just can't walk in and get a gun. You then also have to demonstrate the need for that gun. And particularly if it's high caliber, there's even more that's required. And then you undertake training. And then there is police that actually come to your premise to ensure that you're actually storing those weapons and using those appropriately. And your license isn't for perpetuity. In every state, it's between 3 and 5 years, particularly for high of higher calibre, it's around 3 years. So the laws that were put in place are working, they are world leading, and this is nothing more than a diversion from the real issue around the anti-Semitism that has been allowed to seep into this country because of the lack of leadership of a prime minister who is in this moment, and this is his moment of leadership, but not to divert attention, but to tackle anti-Semitism. And
one of the ideas that the state premiers and territory chief ministers have agreed to go and look at is the idea of changing legislation so that criminal intelligence, not just criminal records, are taken into consideration when it comes to licensing. Surely that's not something that you would object to.
One of these perpetrators had a license. One of his close akin had access to living with this gentleman, this person, to be able to know that there was access to weapons. That's why the licensing works. So this isn't the detail.
Well, the licensing isn't working if police have information, not records that they can't look at.
You're right. Well, that's why sharing that information, but making sure. But there are counterterrorism units within every state police unit in every state. Now, if they know that someone has a gun license and they have access to guns, I would have thought it's beholden on the police to use that. That's process. That's not around the architecture. That's around process of use. And that's where law enforcement agencies need to be more courageous and leaning in, taking licenses and weapons off in a precautionary principle model. That's why the licensing has worked and demonstrated. And that's why they're reviewed, particularly for high calibre, mostly in every state, 3 years, in some cases, every 6 to 12 months.
Would it make sense to have a nationally consistent approach like Western Australia to put a limit of 5 weapons on any individual licence holder?
Now, again, you have to demonstrate the need for the capacity of that firearm. You can't just say, I want to have one of everything. You actually have to demonstrate the need. That's what you're assessed on now. And I think this is what the Prime Minister's trying to play on, the ignorance of the detail of what licensing looks like, because it's politically expedient to get away from the fact that he's ignored his own special envoy into anti-Semitism's report. Now, what I think we should be doing, and if this is the Prime Minister's moment of leadership, and I'll challenge him today, let's recall Parliament. There are 13 recommendations. We should, before Christmas, go back to Parliament and, in fact, look at recommendation 9 that Julian Siegel has put around increasing the screening of those that come to this country around extremist views, including anti-Semitism. And we should go back to Parliament and we should go and do that before Christmas. If you want to grab this moment as the leader of this country and show you're up to leading this country, then you've got to show that you're going to do something about it. And I think every one of us would be prepared to get on a plane and go and do that before Christmas, because otherwise this is all in vain, Mel, and that is not what these people deserve. This is not what Australia is, and this is what we should stand up. We have been given a privileged position as legislators, and we owe it. We owe it in this moment. And this is Anthony Albanese's moment, and he is going to miss it because he doesn't have the courage to take it on.
Leader of the Nationals, David Littleproud there. For a big change of pace now. A chorus of humpback whale sounds captured by underwater microphones off the New South Wales south coast is giving researchers a brand new understanding of whale migration patterns. Here's a little sample. Olaf Meinecker is a research fellow at the Whales and Climate Research Program at Griffith University. He spoke with Mel about how this incredible audio has been captured.
It turns out that those underwater microphones are actually quite expensive because they need to be pressure-proofed and waterproofed, and they also need to last very long underwater. So we actually deployed a unit at Batemans Bay this year and last year, and it was down there for about 6 months. So it's been recording through all that time and recording a lot of sound.
They're recording, 24/7 during the migration season. So how do you sift through all of that audio?
Yeah, so there's two ways about it. And we've taken the hard approach to start with, which is actually going through it manually. And that means we display the frequencies, so we visualize it. And usually, humpback whales have very specific frequencies, so it's relatively easy to sort of pick these ones out. And then we have to sort of, you know, go through all those files, which, I mean, for the last year was over 10,000 files. And the more advanced approach is what we're working on is using AI to actually detect the frequencies of humpback whales automatically. But you need to kind of train the algorithms first. So this is where we are at the moment, sort of halfway there.
So how much do we already know about the language of whales? What do we know about what the sounds might mean?
Well, for humpback whales, there's a complexity to it because they like to change their vocals. And that means every year they're adding new kind of tones and frequencies, which also makes, of course, the detection a bit more difficult, but also the understanding, because what do these new tones and frequencies mean? But there are certain vocals that are staying the same. And I think, you know, we sort of, you know, obviously know social communication between mums and calves. And we also know male singing. So these kind of frequencies, they have repetitive patterns, which are then, you know, easy to pick out. But we obviously can't translate it word to word. And I suppose, you know, they will have a language that will explain certain circumstances and danger. But to actually understand what frequency means, for instance, danger, we would need to actually have that situation captured somewhere out in the wild, and, you know, have visual confirmation of what it actually means.
So much complexity. You're listening to Radio National Breakfast, where whale researcher Olaf Meinecke is my guest. So what's the latest audio that you've collected been able to tell you about, you know, the patterns of migration for humpback whales?
Yeah, so we've for the first time went through all this data from Batemans Bay, and there's never been a hydrophone deployed before in that region. And it actually gave us an interesting insight into the presence of humpback whales. And normally we've got the southern migration, the northern migration, and there is a gap, which means there is usually less whales present when the whales are all up north in the breeding area. But it turns out that pretty much from mid-June onwards, there is 100% detection during the entire time of the recordings. A minor little sort of drop around August, but it's insignificant. And that means that there's really presence of humpback whales through the entire season, and there's no drop in recordings. It suggests that there's obviously a lot of whales, but also sort of supports what people have been saying, that, you know, in recent years, there's a lot more whales present during the entire season, and even whale watch operators have responded and they, you know, sort of extended their season. So this could be because there's more whales, but it could also be some whales just don't do that migration up north anymore and trying to save that energy. If they don't breed, they don't need to have to go all the way up north, and they can socialise on the south coast of New South Wales.
Olaf Meinecke, a research fellow at the Whales and Climate Research Program at Griffith University there. Well, that's about all we've got time for on The Breakfast Wrap today. Every interview was presented by Melissa Clark, produced by the Radio National Breakfast team, and The Breakfast Wrap was produced by Josephine Asher. I'm Lexi Junowick. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll catch you the same time tomorrow.